Hello to everyone and welcome to another episode of CDH Conversations. I'm Krishan Inte, a candidate attorney in the pro bono and human rights practice at CDH. In the pro bono practice, focus is placed on advancing women's rights and strengthening access to justice. Today's episode tackles a deeply urgent and complex reality, which is gender-based violence and femicide, and the impact of the national state of disaster that was recently declared. GBV has been an issue in South Africa for many years. With passing generations, its expression changes, but the root problem remains the same. We will be delving into the recently declared national state of disaster, the state's actions towards the fight, and the overarching question being, what now? We'll also be shining a light on the work done by Women for Change, including hopeful stories and a few upcoming projects. Joining me today are remarkable women making waves in their respective fields. Firstly, we have Sabrina Walter, the founder of Women for Change, together with Malise Joget, operations manager and impact advocacy lead for Women for Change. And lastly, CDH's very own Brigitte Mangel, a director in the pro bono and human rights practice. These women will no doubt provide invaluable insights to the conversation. So thank you everyone for taking the time to join us. I think in starting, I'd like to pose this question to everyone just to give us a little bit of a rundown about what you do and the type of work and areas of expertise you find yourself in.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm Sabrina, the founder of Women for Change. My professional background is in digital marketing, and over the past 10 years, I have used the power of social media and community to build Women for Change into one of South Africa's largest movements advocating against gender-based violence. I have worked alongside survivors, families who have lost loved ones to femicide, activists and communities to raise awareness, advocate and provide support to those affected by GBV. Having run the organization largely on my own for the first 8 years, I still wear many hats, from the executive director to creative director to managing projects and still speaking daily to survivors and family members.
That's amazing. I think, Malise, let's move on to you.
I am Malise Joget, obviously the operations and advocacy manager at Women for Change. I actually found myself in this position because of a life experience of gender-based violence. But it also put me in spaces where the education around abuse is very important. And working with Women for Change has, I think, essentially changed me because we're in the front lines of other people's experiences. At the moment, I work with the team and the sports specialist that we have recently brought in, just responding to messages that we receive via our WhatsApp line and social media, and working on projects and everything in and around the advocacy work, bringing more awareness to the scourge of gender-based violence in South Africa.
That's perfect. Brigitte.
Thanks, Krishan. And thank you, Sabrina and Marlies. It's really such a privilege to be having this conversation with you both today. So, Krishan, as you mentioned, my practice at CDH has a strong focus on women's rights. And practically what that means is that I run strategic litigation and projects that aim to strengthen women's rights and promote access to justice. Sometimes that means pursuing a singular case for my client. So, for example, assisting her to obtain a protection order. But it can also mean pursuing constitutional challenges to legislation that are meant to support and protect women, to ensure that that legislation is amended to properly respond to the lived realities of women all over the country and protect them as our constitutional democracy demands. Much of my project work involves empowerment. I have understood over time through my work that we can only really protect ourselves if we know what our rights are and we know where to go for help. So I often run legal education workshops to explain their rights to women. One of the projects I'm currently running is a legal education workshop at the Saraki Bartman Center for Women and Children here in Cape Town. It's really incredible to be doing this kind of work in the context of a commercial law firm like CDH, and I'm very grateful to be well supported by other members of our practice, management, and colleagues alike in doing this kind of work.
I think the key takeaway there is empowerment, definitely empowerment. This entire conversation is going to be about empowerment. As of the 20th of November, 2025, the South African government has declared GBV and femicide to be a national state of disaster. Women for Change has played a huge role in bringing about awareness and petitioning for this declaration. Sabrina, can you tell us about the events leading up to the petition and what made you decide that this was the most effective route to take?
Yes, absolutely. So for many years, Women for Change focused on survivor support and raising awareness. And then at the end of 2024, I personally reached a point where I felt awareness would not longer be enough and that we would need mobilization and action. I had just come out of a campaign trying to stop Chris Brown from performing in South Africa, which brought significant backlash, harassment, and even death threats to myself and the team members of Women for Change. At the same time, we all saw an extreme increase in horrific cases of violence against women, including a man who murdered his girlfriend and shared the images of her lifeless body on Facebook. And I think it was a very dark time for the woman in South Africa. And I personally was really exhausted. And it was an incredibly emotional time. So I realized that we really needed to shift from awareness to action. For almost a decade, I had spent my time documenting femicide and supporting survivors and showing the public the huge scale of gender-based violence as a crisis. So for me, a national disaster declaration felt like the next logical step. I think we needed the government to officially recognize gender-based violence as the crisis it truly is and start moving with much more urgency than we had seen. We also had an entire national strategic plan on gender-based violence since 2020. And yet, 5 years later, we still saw statistics rising. So in January 2025, Women for Change launched a petition calling for gender-based violence and femicide to be declared a national disaster. Just a couple of weeks later, the 11th of April 2025, we carried our unburied casket to the union buildings and handed over 150,000 signatures at that time to the Deputy Minister of Women, Children and Persons with Disabilities. What followed was a lot of silence from the government. So Women for Change had to continue with advocacy, public pressure. We had several communication with different government departments, but still we didn't feel the urgency that was promised on the 11th of April. So we decided to call for the G20 Women's Shutdown in the beginning of November. And in just 2 weeks leading up to this shutdown, more than 1 million people signed a petition. Over 750,000 people changed their profile pictures to purple, and millions of people around the world joined something that they called the Purple Movement. And then on 20th of November, gender-based violence and femicide was officially classified as a national disaster by our president, Cyril Ramaphosa, which was one day before the actual women's shutdown and the start of the G20 summit in South Africa.
That definitely indicated a huge shift, you know. You said that the focus was really just about getting action and mobilizing people. So how did this affect individual women on the ground? Has the declaration in itself borne any positive outcomes?
I think what we hoped to achieve was the triggering of formal coordinated states response to the crisis that had been treated as a social problem rather than a national emergency, right? A woman is killed every 2.5 hours in South Africa. We wanted government to have no legal basis to continue treating that as anything other than a disaster. The classification under the Disaster Management Act creates a legal obligation to act with coordinated response structure, designated authority, and accountability. What we hoped for was urgency, the same urgency that any other national disaster receives, like COVID-19. They showed us exactly what it could look like in practice. When the government identifies something as a national disaster, it can mobilize resources, coordinate departments, implement interventions, and act with speed and decisiveness, which you've seen with other national disasters earlier this year as well. It showed all of us that the government has the ability to enforce change when it chooses to, and that is precisely what makes the continued inadequacy of the response to gender-based violence and femicide so devastating. It feels like government simply does not care enough about the women and children of South Africa to extend them the same urgency. The classification was supposed to change that. It was supposed to remove every excuse, because when you can mobilize an entire country in weeks over a virus, but decades pass with women dying every 2.5 hours and no coordinated response follows, that is not just a capacity problem. It's literally the priority that we have problems with.
And I think then we'll move on to Brigitte. The national strategic plan has been formulated in respect of this declaration. So from a legal perspective, what is your assessment of the action plan? And do you expect to see changes in how GBV cases are handled and prioritized?
So I think it's important to start by just spotlighting some of the key aspects of the plan and its response. What's interesting is that government didn't start from scratch. Instead, it recognized that our country already had a fairly comprehensive roadmap in the form of the National Strategic Plan on Gender-Based Violence and Femicide, which was adopted in 2020. The challenge was never really the absence of a plan. It was the pace and coordination of implementation, as both Sabrina and Marlies have mentioned. The proposed national state of disaster was therefore intended to accelerate the implementation of that existing framework and mobilize resources more urgently. The strategic plan itself is built around several key pillars. First, it focuses on prevention in addressing the social norms, attitudes, and behaviors that drive violence against women and children in the first place. Second, it seeks to strengthen survivor-centered support services, including shelters, psychosocial support, healthcare, and access to justice. Another important aspect is improving the criminal justice response by strengthening policing, investigations, prosecutions, and accountability. That's incredibly important. The plan also recognizes the link between economic vulnerability and abuse, and therefore includes measures aimed at women's economic empowerment and financial independence. Importantly, it also emphasizes better coordination across government departments, civil society, and the private sector, as well as improved data collection and monitoring so that interventions can be evidence-based and their effectiveness can be properly measured. At its core, the plan acknowledges that GBVF is not simply a criminal justice issue. It's a societal issue that requires a collective response, one that combines prevention, protection, accountability, and long-term social change.
I think the key word there is implementation, because government frequently will fall short when it comes to coordinating between the different departments. So that kind of makes implementation fall flat. So what are the different safeguards that should be implemented to ensure that the plan is then not just well written, but then also properly implemented?
Yeah. And, you know, I think over the years, there's been the criticism that classifications don't translate into implementation. And I think that criticism is entirely valid. South Africa is not short of policy strategies or legislative frameworks. In many respects, we have some of the most impressive and progressive laws in the world. The challenge has often been turning those commitments into tangible outcomes for the people they're intended to protect. If we want this plan to be more than a well-written document, several things are essential. Firstly, implementation must be properly funded. Too often, ambitious commitments are made without corresponding budgets. Shelters, victim support services, specialized investigators, prosecutors, social workers, and prevention programs all require sustained financial investment. Second, there must be clear accountability mechanisms. Every department and institution involved should have measurable targets, timelines, and reporting obligations. If commitments are not met, there should be consequences and public scrutiny. Third, we need reliable data. We can't manage what we don't measure. Accurate and transparent reporting on GBVF cases, conviction rates, protection order compliance, service delivery, and survivor outcomes are critical to understanding what's working and where the gaps remain. Another safeguard is meaningful collaboration with civil society. Many of the organizations doing frontline GBVF work have decades of experience and direct engagement with survivors. Their voices need to inform implementation and not simply be consulted after decisions have already been made. Finally, we need to view implementation through the lens of the survivor's experience. A woman seeking a protection order does not experience government in separate departments. She experiences a system. If she reports violence at a police station, seeks medical care, applies for a protection order, requires shelter, every part of that system must work together effectively. Success should ultimately be measured not by the number of policies adopted, but by whether survivors are safe, better supported, and able to access true justice.
Those are definitely important safeguards. Those actions will definitely bring about the change that Marlies was mentioning, the fact that we need to view this as a social problem rather than an emergency. There needs to be some sort of ongoing measures put in place. And I think then we'll move on to the next segment where we speak more positively, I suppose. I think for Sabrina, Women for Change has definitely played a massive role in bringing about this classification. We know that your organization is also involved in many other projects and initiatives. So can you tell us about those endeavors and in particular, any sort of success stories?
Yes, absolutely. So for me personally, I believe that the Unburied Casket is one of the most impactful campaigns Women for Change has ever led. Together with Edelman Africa, we created a real oversized casket adorned with 5,578 purple beads, one purple bead for every woman murdered in South Africa within a single year. And inside the casket, we show the faces of the beautiful women whose lives were stolen through femicide. The unburied casket became one of the most powerful symbols of the fight against femicide in South Africa. And since its launch in April 2025, it has traveled across the country. And what I think is really special is that whenever the casket travels and you see people interacting with it, you can really witness how it forces people to stop, reflect, and confront the devastating reality behind those statistics. For me personally, the most impactful part of our work is not campaigns, projects, or petition. It really is the trust survivors and families place into us. I think that trust is something that I would never take for granted. Women for Change has become a lifeline for millions of people across South Africa. And I believe we have created a space where survivors can speak without fear and where they really feel that their voices matter. And this is the real impact. And then success for me, it's, I wouldn't call it the little things, but it's the missing child that we shared on our social media platforms that is later found safe. And it's the message from a family sending us and say, get it and grant him bail. After public pressure helped bring attention to a case that we shared on our social media platforms. Those moments really remind me why this work matters.
I think you said it perfectly. Women for Change is definitely a lifeline for a lot of people, but it is understandable that this work can get quite challenging and quite emotional and dark at times because the law is quite slow to change and implementation, as Brigitte had mentioned, is even slower. So I'll pose this question to Melise. What are some of the challenges that Women for Change faces when handling these types of cases?
The honest answer is absolutely everything. We are a small NPO. We have no institutional funding, no government funding, and no private funding. We literally run on donations. The legal system moves also very slowly. And like you said earlier, implementation is even slower. We see women return to us months after getting protection orders because those orders aren't being enforced and there are no other ways of enforcing them other than through the police. We see cases closed without prosecution and the administration burden of running an NPO while also doing frontline advocacy is relentless. What people don't always realize is that the Purple Movement and the entire petition campaign, the shutdown, none of it, we had any financial backing. There was actually no budget for the shutdown at all. There's no institutional support, as I said, and yet the impact was immense. It changed the national conversation. It resulted in the classification of gender-based violence and femicide as a national disaster. And that is what happens when people who truly care decide to keep showing up anyway. And we keep doing it no matter what. We also carry an enormous amount of emotional weight as a team. You can't hear these stories and remain untouched by them. But we make conscious choice every day to carry that weight and keep going, even when it's hard, even when it feels like the system is designed to exhaust and fail you into silence. And the gap between what is written in the policy and what happens in women's lives every day is literally the space that we fill. So we just continue to refuse to look away no matter how hard it is.
It takes people like you that look to the vulnerable to help them. I think that is the most important part of the work. So I think for Brigitte, your focus is obviously on helping women enforce protection orders and making sure that you challenge legislation in terms of litigation and the rights that come with any legislative violations. So from your observations, how does GBV affect women daily in terms of their economic standing, their mental and their psychological state?
Yeah. So one of the most important things to understand about GBV is that its impact extends far, far beyond the immediate incident of abuse. It affects virtually every aspect of a woman's life, often in ways that are invisible to those around her. Economically, many women become trapped in abusive relationships because of financial dependence. Abuse frequently includes forms of economic control, so restricting access to money, preventing a woman from working, controlling her earnings, or creating debt in her name. Even where a woman is employed, the trauma associated with ongoing abuse can affect attendance, productivity, and career progression. Some women lose their jobs altogether because of the instability and disruption that violence creates in their lives. The psychological impact can be equally, if not even more, profound. Many survivors experience chronic anxiety, depression, hypervigilance, sleep disturbances, and a persistent sense of fear. Living with the threat of violence can fundamentally alter how a person moves through the world. Something as simple as going to work, taking children to school, or answering a phone call can become a source of stress and apprehension. In my work, I often see how abuse erodes a person's sense of autonomy and self-worth over time. By the time many women seek legal assistance, they've often endured months or sometimes years of intimidation, manipulation, and control. The violence can be physical, but it's frequently accompanied by emotional and psychological abuse designed to undermine confidence and independence. What's particularly concerning is that the effects don't end when a protection order is granted, and at times they can even be exacerbated. While protection orders are an important legal safeguard, survivors often continue to face economic hardship, ongoing fear, and the emotional consequences of what they've experienced. Recovery is not a single event, it's a process. That's why I think it's so important for our response to GBV to go far beyond the legal system alone. Legal remedies are essential, there's no doubt about that. But women also need access to economic opportunities, psychosocial support, safe housing, healthcare, and community support. If we focus only on the violence itself and not on its long-term consequences, we address the symptom but not the full impact.
Those are some harrowing, harrowing consequences. In saying that, I'll pose this question to Maliz. So I'm a Gen Z. My generation is rebelling against some of the norms that have been set by older generations in terms of self-expression and cultural standards. So would you say that this is translating into the GBV landscape?
I'm going to start with just explaining like what has happened with us with regards to getting to the shutdown, and then I'll respond to you about GBV because they relate to one another. So the road to the shutdown was not one we walked lightly. By the point we were exhausted, and in the way that only comes from years of fighting the system that simply isn't listening. And I think Gen Zs are having a similar experience right now. We had put ourselves into the Chris Brown petition, which not only exposed how little this country does hold perpetrators accountable, but also opened us up to significant harassment. That experience was a stark, painful reminder of how unprotected advocates in this space are and how emboldened those who oppose this work can be when the state offers no meaningful deterrent. Taking into consideration the G20, the petition handed over on the 11th of April, and the sporadic communication from government pertaining to our petition, there needed to be a stronger call for action. We knew that there would be worldwide attention on the country around the G20 on South African soil, and that if anything was going to move, it would be when all eyes were on us. The shutdown was a way to commemorate women we had lost to the scourge, and because of so many women in South Africa were affected daily, it was the safest, most meaningful way to respond. And what the shutdown also showed us is when Gen Z showed us is that digital is not just where young people socialize. It is where they organize, where they grieve, where they speak truth to power, and increasingly where they reach out for help. This is one of the reasons we intentionally built our survivor support presence on Instagram and Facebook, and now the WhatsApp line as well. We meet people where they are, and our WhatsApp support line exists for exactly that reason, because a Gen Z woman in crisis is far more likely to send us a message than call a hotline. This is just how the generation communicates, and we have a responsibility to honor that. We did not, however, anticipate how large it would become.
So, Sabrina, looking ahead, there's clearly a lot that still needs to be done. Maliz had mentioned that you guys operate on donations primarily. But looking forward, what are the upcoming projects or initiatives that you are excited about?
Yes, Melise mentioned that we still don't have institutional funding, and it's actually always amazing how far we came and what we're still planning. And she also just mentioned our survivor support line, which will be our key focus, especially this year. So just a couple of weeks ago, we actually launched one of South Africa's first digital WhatsApp interventions for survivors of gender-based violence and femicide, a very simple platform to use. And also looking that 26 million people in South Africa use WhatsApp actively, it felt for us a very safe way to move from Instagram and Facebook to WhatsApp. And the platform is, as I mentioned, very simple to use. Anyone affected by gender-based violence can send us a WhatsApp message and choose from four options, which is either talk to us, report a femicide, share your story, or access critical crisis resources. Through the support line, our trained support specialist will then provide emotional support, guidance, referrals to in-house counseling and legal services. And once again, we created another safe space for survivors to be heard. And it was incredibly important for me that this support line was also designed to be accessible, survivor-centered and non-judgmental. With the immense growth we have experienced, especially since the Purple Movement and the shutdown, our major focus at the moment is obviously strengthening our operations and securing sustainable funding so we can actually continue our important work the way we really need to. And we're also working on a few meaningful projects behind the scenes that we will share over the upcoming months. And then, of course, another major focus remains on government accountability. While gender-based violence and femicide was classified a national disaster, the work is obviously far from over. So we will continue pushing for real implementation, for transparency, to get the right reports, and for measurable action. And for those who want to support organizations like Women for Change, I think there's many ways to get involved. Very simple is follow us and share our social media posts. Visibility and awareness are very, very important, and they can really have real impact on cases and in creating public pressure, which we have seen with the G20 shutdown. Very important, speak up against gender-based violence in your everyday conversations. Educate the people around you, your friends, your family members, and your colleagues. And most importantly, believe, listen, and support survivors. And if you're able to, consider making a donation, or if you're a business owner, consider supporting organizations like Women for Change through your CSI budget.
That's great. Sabrina, you've been named part of the 100 people that are the most influential for 2026, according to Time. Can you tell us about that journey and what it took to get there, what it means for you?
Yeah, being named one of the Time 100 World's Most Influential People is an incredible honor. And it was really never something I set out to achieve or even imagine it would happen. For the past 10 years, I have simply followed my passion and responded to what I believe is one of the biggest human rights crises facing South Africa. So every step of the journey has been driven by one goal only, which is to help end this pandemic of violence and stand alongside survivors. I think the journey, which I think many would think so, can be really difficult, painful, and also feels often lonely. There have been many tears, moments of self-doubt and sacrifices along the way. But I think the Time 100 is an important reminder for me and for the community that one small voice can grow into an entire movement capable of creating real change, impact, and a movement that was able to reach a global audience.
That's amazing. So we've heard from the Women for Change representatives that, you know, the one goal is to just end this epidemic, end this nightmare for millions of women. For you, Brigitte, are there any new cases or programs that signal where your work is headed?
Yeah, so one of my largest cases and what my practice is expanding into more relates to the systemic issue of forced sterilizations and obstetric violence that's occurring all over our country in our public hospitals. It's devastating that what seems to be happening is that healthcare professionals who are meant to support and protect women during their most vulnerable, emotional, and sometimes difficult experiences giving birth are instead taking matters into their own hands and sterilizing women without their consent. It's a really, really difficult legal case to solve because firstly, we shouldn't need laws to tell healthcare professionals not to overstep their bounds. But secondly, also because in many of the cases we're seeing, hospital records have been either lost or destroyed, and that means proving the case becomes exceptionally difficult. But what's most heartbreaking is that even if we are successful entirely, the devastating harm has already been done, which is that a woman can no longer bear children, and she's been robbed of that beautiful sacred opportunity without her consent. There's no amount of money in the world that can heal that hurt, but we have to try to achieve some sense of justice, because it's a pervasive issue that can't be left to endure in our constitutional democracy or in any society for that matter. As I say, the case is ongoing, and we're hoping to make some important headway soon in engaging the Department of Health constructively, and if necessary, taking the matter further to court.
There's definitely a difficult legal issue, obstetric violence, and you sound very positive in going forward with this case. So what keeps you motivated when doing this type of work? Was there a particular moment maybe that solidified your decision to become involved in women's rights work?
I don't know that there was a singular moment. I really believe that this work is my calling and my purpose. I knew I wanted to be a human rights lawyer even as a teenager. I had the sense that I wanted to fight for something. And to be able to fight for the rights of women, given our country's social, economic, and political landscape, is a responsibility and a privilege I don't take lightly. I don't for a second think that I can single-handedly, positively change the landscape for women, but I know I can make a contribution to that fight. Most importantly, I know that for all of us, sometimes we just need someone to hear us and to tell us they will fight for us and alongside us. To be able to make this kind of contribution on a human level and support my clients through some of the most difficult times of their lives is what's motivating, inspiring, and humbling all at the same time. I'm really, really lucky that I get to do the work I do.
That's beautiful. And I think we'll close out with one last question, kind of a fire round just for everyone. What advice do you have for a young candidate attorney like myself entering this field or wanting to do this type of work? We can start with you, Melise.
Know why you're here before you start, because the work will test you. The law is slow, implementation is slower, the systems you're trying to change were not designed with women's safety in mind. You will have to fight every inch. Get comfortable with it. Find your community. You cannot do this work alone and sustain yourself. Stay close to the people you are doing this for, because it will remind you why you're still doing it. And when you feel like nothing is changing, go back to one survivor whose life is different because of something you did. Most of all, become incredibly familiar with the psychology of human behavior. I cannot stress that enough, because you cannot work with humans every day and not understand why they make the decisions that they do. You cannot serve humans appropriately if you don't understand them. I will say that. I'll put a billboard up saying that. Even the magistrates don't seem to have the understanding of human behavior. In every sphere of this work, that is vital.
My advice is quite short. I would say make sure this work is truly your passion. I recently watched the trials of Winnie Mandela on Netflix, and she said, at no point do you wake up and decide to become a human rights defender. It's something society does to you. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I think for me, this work can be incredibly meaningful, and it's my absolute passion, but it can also be emotionally heavy. So if you are only driven by achievements, by awards, or funding opportunities in gender-based violence, you will burn out very quickly. To do this kind of work successfully, you need to be grounded in compassion and have a deep desire to serve others. So I think passion really is everything to fight the scourge of gender-based violence.
A lot of what I wanted to say has already been so brilliantly said by Sabrina and Melise, but I think it bears repetition. My first piece of advice would be to stay close to the reality of the work. It's really easy, especially as a young, enthusiastic, excited lawyer, to become focused on the legal doctrine, the case law, and the procedural aspects. All of that is important, but in this field, you are ultimately dealing with people's lived experiences of trauma, fear, and survival. Keeping that human reality at the center of your work will guide both your judgment and your compassion. Secondly, understand that this work is not only about courtroom victories. Of course, litigation and legal advocacy are important, but helping a survivor understand her rights, ensuring she can access a protection order or working with organizations that provide shelter and psychological support must be front of mind at all times. The law is one part of a much, much larger ecosystem. Third, invest in resilience, but also in your own boundaries. This is emotionally demanding work and burnout is real. You can't sustain long-term impact if you're constantly depleted. Learning how to remain effective without absorbing everything emotionally is an essential professional skill in this field. And finally, stay committed to the long-term view. Change in the gender-based violence space is often slow and incremental. There will be moments of frustration, but also moments where you see real, tangible impact in someone's life. Those moments matter, and they are what make the work worthwhile.
Those are such, such brilliant tips. So thank you, Sabrina, Maliz, and Brigitta for sharing your insights and sharing the extraordinary work that you do. I think one thing that's made clear today is that the fight is more than policymaking. It demands sustained action and collaboration. And we've heard about the realities on the ground and the important work that Women for Change does and how they work together with pro bono practices like CDHs. These are the conversations we should be having with women that refuse to accept the status quo. And these three women are definitely women that don't accept the status quo. So my takeaway is definitely that change, even if it's slow and incremental, as Brigitta said, is still change and it remains important. So to all the listeners, the conversation should not end here. Until next time, thank you for joining us.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.